Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast in which you get to determine whether Andrew or I are very lucid this episode. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir.
So, yes, welcome back for episode 6, everyone. Andrew, thank you for coming back after Where the Buffalo Roams.
Well, David, it's monologuing doesn't work so well in a podcast format, so I guess I'm honor-bound to be here.
Yeah, that is true. And the good news, folks, is not to tip our hat too much in advance, but we have a film that is less likely to make Andrew angry this time. So that's a very good...
Yeah, in large part because I picked this one. Yeah, so when last we left our heroes, I guess we were leaving the desert of Las Vegas and Bat Country, and we decided to hop on a train and go straight to the Acid West. So this week, we're looking at Jim Jarmusch's 1995 art house western, Dead Man.
Yes, that is correct. Starring Johnny Depp and Gary Farmer, amongst about a billion others. But we'll get to them in due time. What was our connection to this from the last episode to this one, Andrew?
The connection from last time is Where the Buffalo Roam had a soundtrack by Canada's most valuable export, Neil Young. And Dead Man also features a soundtrack by Mr. Helpless, Helpless, Helpless himself, Neil Young.
Really? We're not going to call Lisa Lougheed our, you know, most important export?
It depends where the markets are at these days. It's also variable, right?
I'm just saying, the Raccoons was one of the most vital things we ever put out there. And Run With Us will forever be in our hearts.
It's true. It's very true. I mean, the 1970s had Chinatown, and the last century of Canada had the Raccoons.
Exactly. But we digress.
We always do. So, yes. I guess my question to you, Dave, to start us off, is Jim Jarmusch, the filmmaker, he occupies this very weird space where a lot of people, a lot of casual cinema goers, and I don't mean that dismissively. I know there's that tendency to always think of mainstream culture as a negative, but I'd say the average film-going audience probably doesn't have a huge awareness of him. But he seems to have this weird cultural cachet with film students and people on the festival circuit. He occupies this weird space of cool modern American cinema. And I guess I'm asking you, Dave, what is your experience with Double J?
I can't lie. It's kind of limited. It's the thing, Jarmusch is somebody I've always been aware of, and I've seen several of his films, including Dead Man. I've also seen Mystery Train, which I love, which is a great film if people haven't seen that one. And I think a great deal of people I think our age, Ghost Dog was sort of a big gateway entry point into his work, as it were. And I think that's kind of... It's weird, because you say that he sort of occupies this space, and at the same time, I kind of look at him, and I have such a thorough connection of him to the 90s, that he doesn't really register to me almost as a contemporary filmmaker in the same way, you know, other filmmakers of that period have gone on and continue to have a great deal of either, you know, pop cultural reverence or, you know, just cultural relevance in general, as it were. And maybe I'm off on a tangent of that, but I'm trying to think about when the last time a Jarmusch film really sort of broke through, and it's not coming to me.
Well, because his career is a lot longer than some people may think, especially though after Ghost Dog and Dead Man, or Dead Man and Ghost Dog respectively, his output has dropped pretty dramatically because, let's see, after Ghost Dog, he did Coffee and Cigarettes, and I remember that came out when I was in first year of university. And everybody thought it was cool because, you know, you get to see RZA and Bill Murray having a laugh together. But it's not really a film, you know?
Well, it's on top of which, if I'm not mistaken, that one's actually comprised of shorts that he had released in different stages over the course of, what, like 15 years
preceding? Yeah, like that was an ongoing project. It's really more of a compilation than anything. But since then, there's been that, Broken Flowers, which, you know, if you're one of those people that thinks, you know, soundtrack of Calypso music while Bill Murray looks sadly at a wall, if you think that's art, this is the film for you. And then more recently, he did The Limits of Control, which is interesting, but that's very much a film student movie, I think. And Only Lovers Left Alive, which I haven't seen, but...
Right, never... that was his, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that was 2016, I think.
Yeah, so, okay, so I have to rescind a little bit, because that one did get quite a bit of cultural, or that one, I think, did end up attracting a fair amount of attention, if only for its cast. I mean, the combination of Tilda Swinton and, oh god, why am I blanking? Tom Hiddleston, there we go.
Yeah, because I think that one was up for the Palme d'Or. But Jarmusch, it's weird, because stylistically... I find his films vary greatly over time, but there are a couple central things in most of his films, aside from like his really early ones. He'll generally work with an ensemble cast.
Yeah.
It's so weird because he's very Hitchcockian in the sense that depending on what decade you look at, he's making a sort of different style of film. Because his early work, Stranger Than Paradise in particular, is such a minimalistic film. I don't think the camera ever actually moves over the course of 90 minutes. But he often works with musicians. In this film, we get Iggy Pop. He's done several films, Down by Law with Tom Waits. John Lurie in Stranger Than Paradise.
In the Mystery Train, it is, the punk.
Screaming movie. Jay Hawkins?
Was it him? I'm trying to remember. Okay, and excuse me, folks, while I grab my copy of this one off the shelf here. Mystery Train.
And Joe Strummer is also in it as well.
That's the one I'm thinking of, yes, Strummer.
Yeah. And, like, he has some actors that he'll revisit a whole bunch, and then he has... Then he has Dead Man, which comes off as kind of... It doesn't neatly fit into either category, because it's not a cool film in the sense, like, it's not hip. It's not sort of countercultural in the way that his later films were, but there's definitely much more of an emphasis on sort of formal polish, on a cohesive narrative, if not always a coherent one. Dead Man always stands out as a Jarmusch film, and often when I'm thinking about this, I don't remember that it's a Jim Jarmusch film. I only saw this film for the first time when I was going to the University of Toronto working with the intro class, but it left quite the impression on me. And as far as a film to wash out the taste of Where Buffalo Roam, I figured I could do worse than this one.
No, that is completely fair, as it stands. So I guess, you know, to sort of give everybody a sense as to what this film we're discussing is about. You described it, Andrew, earlier as an acid western up front. And maybe you can give everybody just a little hint of what that means when you say that.
Well, yeah. I mean, the western as a genre is pretty well codified. I think you ask anybody going to the movies, what do you think of when you think of Westerns? They can pick out the broad strokes, you know. There's white hats versus black hats, tension between the frontier and the community, and eventually the hero rides off into the sunset. You know, there's more to it than that, but in broad strokes. But from the 1970s onward, I think El Topo is the first one I could think of. But you can argue that some of Leone's work, his spaghetti western trilogy as well, really plays with some of the codes within the genre.
Yes.
The idea of challenging like the black and white morality. In the case of El Topo, it's incorporating very overt moments of surrealism or sort of a more allegorical style of filmmaking. Dead Man, I think, definitely takes more from that kind of an approach to a Western. Because the iconography is familiar, but Jarmusch is doing very different things with it than, say, John Ford ever would have imagined to do. So it's a Western that comes to us through the sensibilities of surrealism, through art house cinema, through even to some degree post-colonial cinema. And basically the result is, yeah, it's sort of a repurposing of a very familiar genre form.
Yeah, so the general gist of, and we'll get more into that in a moment in terms of the formal elements and certainly the thematic elements of the film, but the general narrative of the film, just to put it broadly speaking, follows that of an accountant named William Blake, played by a young Johnny Depp, who's on his way to the town of Machine, in the far west, riding the train all the way to the end of the line where he's to take up his new position for a metalworks owned by a one Mr. Dickinson, played by the late, great Robert Mitchum in his last role. However, when he gets there, he, along with, you know, taking in the absolute hellscape that is the West and this town in particular, he discovers that due to either miscommunication or just outright how should we say? I don't want to say lies, but, you know,
cruelty and negligence.
Exactly. His position, the position he was coming down to fill, despite spending every last dollar he has to get there, has been taken over by someone else. And he quickly finds himself sort of stumbling in the town, ends up meeting a woman, and the end result ends up finding him surrounded by two corpses, one which he kills, and putting him on the run with a bullet in him that can't quite be taken out. And from there, he meets an individual known as who we will come to know as Nobody, played by Gary Farmer, an Aboriginal man who's come across him, and from there, the film sort of follows their journey with ostensibly a trio of gunmen on their trail.
Hired by Dickinson, when we learn that the man that he killed is actually Dickinson's youngest son. So yeah. There's kind of two different plot threads that are happening. There's the pursuit of Blake by the three hired killers. But at the same time, there's also Blake and Nobody's journey to the coast, especially after Nobody realizes that, well, William Blake is William Blake, the famous, a romantic poet, is he generally considered as?
You would think I could remember, given that I actually wrote a little project on William Blake back in high school as part of my Red Dragon novel study. However, I have to admit, I am completely blanking on all that knowledge at the moment.
Well, what we do know is that Blake was a man of letters, a real Renaissance man, a poet. He wrote prose. He also painted. Most of his work was concerned with the relationship between the material and the spiritual and the possibility of transcending one into the other. So Nobody realizes that the William Blake he meets is named after a poet he is familiar with. He believes that it can't possibly be a coincidence, and then takes it upon himself to get Blake to the coast so he can send him back to the spirit realm where he belongs.
Yeah, and yeah, that's basically the film in a nutshell, but that makes it, and this is the odd thing, because it makes the film seem far more straightforward than it actually is, because this is a film that is really a sort of, I use the word meandering, but I don't think that that's really quite right, because, and I actually, to come back to a point you brought up, the sort of episodic nature of at least Jarmusch's early works, why I think you're keeping in mind my limited context and knowledge of his overall oeuvre, as it were. The key thing with Jarmusch compared to something like, say, Mystery Train, which is very clearly divided into episodes, in the case of this film, you're right in the sense that there is an overall cohesive narrative, but it is sort of, you know, marked and divided by particular segments and encounters, which almost give the film still an episodic quality throughout. Certainly there's the initial arrival in Machine, there's the initial wandering of William Blake and Nobody, which leads to their eventual encounter with, I refer to them as the mountain men. You refer to them as the highwaymen.
Guess they didn't have highways back then, so.
Yeah, so, well, whatever they are, it's hard to say, whatever they are, a trio of other individuals played by, of all people, Iggy Pop, Jared Harris, and Billy Bob Thornton. In a very unique meeting. And it keeps going on and on like this with these sort of encounters throughout. So, on one hand, you're right. I think this is certainly more cohesive a work as it is. But it still feels very loose, structurally speaking. Yeah.
Instead of meandering, I would say it's an open film in the sense where... And like Jarmusch as part of his style, he's been pretty outspoken about saying, well, I'm credited as the director, and usually have a hand in the writing in that, but he's like, ultimately, like, his approach to filmmaking is to allow for improvisation and allowing these organic moments to come through, and like very much working with his actors.
Yes.
And I think the sort of episodic frame that emerges, even in films that are presumably more narrative-driven, I think you're right that probably is a function of that. This is a film that is built on sequences. And it's sort of ironic that the film opens with a train going on its one course to the end of the line, because the moment that Blake gets off that train, though, everything is unclear, not just to him as a character, but even to us as viewers. The narrative becomes a bit more freeform. And even though there's a host of moments in this film and certain allegories, certain visual or thematic metaphors that are employed, like, we're presented with all of these, and they're clearly adding up to something, but I think the film is also very hesitant to definitively say what that is. So the film itself becomes allegorical, but of what? And that's sort of where the fun is.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, and I think, again, maybe this speaks to why Jarmusch almost is somebody that, you know, sort of has the position you were discussing earlier. Because, in a weird way, his film is... It is clearly, loosely speaking, an art house western, to be blunt. I mean, this is not something that's going to be, as we've already acknowledged here, if you come in expecting an Eastwood Western, this isn't it. That's not the kind of film you're going to be getting. At the same time, even in describing that gives the impression that this is a film that is more difficult to wrap one's mind around than it really is, because the film is not... Why there is subtext here, it's not, you know, trying to be obtuse in ultimately what it's talking about. I mean, this is a film that is kind of, it's a mediation on death. It is a look at the notion of death in American culture. It is certainly looking back and sort of repositioning, you know, what American expansionism into the West actually was, and ultimately viewing it as an inherently destructive force, as it were. What ends up sort of, again, what sort of really gives it the impression of maybe being more obtuse than it is certainly, I think, the combination of the almost subjective approach that Jarmusch takes to filming it. Because this is a film that very, right from its opening moments, very squarely puts us within the mindset of William Blake as a character. That extended train sequence, one of the things that happens is... We see him on the train, and what happens repeatedly throughout it is he falls asleep, which is, you know, communicated through these fades to black. And every time he reawakens, from his perspective, seeing yet a completely different bunch of people on this train, having taken the place of everyone else who was there prior when he was awake.
Yeah, he has no sense of how much time has passed, where he is, and the audience, through the use of very rapid fades to blacks and then rising back up from it, we lose that sense of time and space as well. So the moment that Crispin Glover makes his appearance, Blake doesn't know what to make of it, and we as the audience, we don't entirely know if this is really happening, if it's just a projection of some kind. And especially by the time we get to the end of the film, you know, is this guy foreseeing the future? Is he just talking crazy? It's It's very weird. And I love that sequence because it's just so strange.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it is very much this sort of... how would you almost... like? I mean, it's strange and very surreal. And I mean, obviously having... you know, once you involve Crispin Glover in anything, I think that's pretty much a given that that's the direction you're going to end up going. there. And... but again, it's a sequence which, as strange as it is, it's not subtle in what it's doing. I mean, this is a sequence which ultimately builds to, again, everybody on the train more or less shooting out of it to massacre a bunch of buffalo.
Yeah. At the behest- and I mean, not even claiming their hides or anything. They're killing buffalo because they can, and then they're just leaving them there. And this is the West that Blake has come to.
Yeah, and we should also note that the character that Crispin Glover is playing is basically the train's engineer, which means the entire section of this sequence, when he comes back to speak to William Blake, ostensibly there is nobody at control of the wheel of this train, which almost makes you wonder, again, if you want to read that in a sort of metaphoric sense. As to what Jarmusch is saying. I mean, go at it. I think it's something that fully invites that at that point.
Well, yeah, and from the very outset, though, I mean, one thing I think we could probably both agree that this film's doing, it's reversing the classic Western motif of the coming of civilization. Because you look at, say, Rio Bravo, The Searchers... I haven't seen nearly enough old Westerns, but, or Shane, for instance, most of the narratives in these are sort of the burgeoning community binding themselves together to face down a threat from the outside. Whereas from, even before he arrives in the town of Machine, and the name of this town is not accidental.
No, not even remotely.
When we get to the town, it's just, it's a nightmare. The way that it's shot in monochrome, and especially filmed by cinematographer and longtime collaborator with Wim Wenders, Robbie Mueller, it is very stark images. And it's just people drinking and consorting with prostitutes, pointing guns at each other, and like an entire wall of animal skulls. Like, the city is a figuration of, you know, the metal shop and death.
Yeah.
It's just, the city here in this film is completely inorganic, and it's only by going outside of that into the wild, which is normally, in classic Western genre pieces, that's where the threat is, whereas here, that's the only place that seems to make sense.
Yeah, especially, I mean, it's very notable, there's a great, at the end of the sequence when Blake is discovers that he doesn't have a job and confronts Dickinson, which, again... God bless Robert Mitchum and his absolutely loony performance.
Yeah. He has two scenes, and he steals the entire film.
Yeah, exactly. And he just, you know, the whole sequence ends with basically Blake wandering out, you know, having more or less resigned himself to the fact that, you know, there is nothing for him here. And there's these great shots of him just getting lost in the machine factory itself and becoming in this almost disorienting labyrinth, which is, you know, again, not accidental whatsoever in terms of what Jarmusch is suggesting.
Yeah, it's like if Franz Kafka decided to write a pulp novel about cowboys, you know? And, but yeah, but then the moment that he goes on the run and he encounters nobody, all of a sudden we see the natural landscape and like the mountain ranges and the forest, and it shot so beautifully. Like this is at one time a very ugly and harsh film, but especially in the closing when they reach sort of the funeral site, like it's there's a power to the images there.
Oh, unmistakably. Like, I mean, this is not, you know, again, even if this is Jarmusch's improvisational nature in terms of how he approaches things, there is a firm grasp and control here. Like, nothing is done for the sake of just doing it. There is, you know, clear design and precision in what's done, such as when we see, you know, even little things such as comedy beats in this film. There is a wonderful shot when, again, Blake confronting Mitchum's Dickinson early on in the film, you slowly see the shotgun creep into the frame. That is just gut-bustingly hilarious, and yet, you know, staggeringly beautiful at the same time.
Like, it's a well-composed film. You're not wrong there, and, like, especially Lance Henriksen giving the drive treatment to that guy's head.
Yeah, that is...
That stays with you. But, I mean, I think that moment, you see, like, this really ornate stage sequence for an evil man to come along and then pulp somebody's skull with a boot in the middle of it. And I think that really expresses sort of the two tendencies of this film's visual composition right there.
Yeah, and again, so the sort of extremes of tone, because this is a film dealing with some pretty heavy subject matter, but it's also an incredibly, incredibly funny film as you go through it in terms of the sort of variance in tone, and not in a way that is, it's not like these things are in opposition to one another. I mean, they are very complementary in terms of how they're weaved in and out of the film. And again, I think a large part of this ends up being because, to come back to the character of William Blake and Johnny Depp's portrayal of him here, this is a figure who, in many ways, is remarkably passive for the bulk of this film. And not only passive, but he's functioned, even though, you know, he is the man who is indeed the dead man, our dying man throughout this. His role is that of observer, for the most part. And it's really just a series of encounters with increasingly peculiar individuals and peculiar components of American culture as it was then, and, you know, obviously the echoes of what we now see now in contemporary American culture.
Blake is a character that, from the outset, he does not understand anything that's happening to him, and he doesn't know how to act about it. So whether it's him being presented as the Easterner coming out to the West and being in over his head, him not being able to make good on the letter that he's given and, like, the paper effectively becoming useless, him not being able to stand up and being turned away by Dickinson. Even the moment that Charlie confronts him in the bedroom, played by Gabriel Byrne, that self, the scene is a weird allusion to Blake's poem, what is it, The Sick Rose?
I think so.
But yeah, even then, like, he basically is lying in bed, pulling the sheets over his head while he witnesses a lover's quarrel because he doesn't know what to do. And even by the time he meets Nobody, I mean, Nobody is absolutely over the moon and astounded by the fact that he has met who he sees as the reincarnation of William Blake. And William Blake has no idea who William Blake is.
See, this is a curious thing, actually. You say that he thinks he's met the reincarnation of William Blake. And this is strange, because the first time I watched this film a few years ago, my take on it at first was, it's like, okay, does he actually think, you know, that, you know, he is legitimately William Blake? Because one of the things we end up discovering is that Nobody's education is very particular, and in some ways kind of, I think we could say, somewhat fragmentary in a certain way. And, like I said, that to me, the first time I watched it, it's like, okay, that's kind of offensive if that's the road they're going about it. This time through, I never got, you know, watching particularly Gary Farmer's performance, I'm not so much sure, I mean, it's even an issue of it being reincarnation or an issue of that it's just, you know, almost his own bemusement with the coincidence and seeing it as a symbol of something, whether it's, you know, not necessarily an overt, idea of reincarnation necessarily, but...
Yeah, not in the sense of, like, in, you know, the old Dr. Livingston novels where, like, everyone falls to their knees and worships the white man because they think he's God, you know? Yeah. And that's something I think that's very important to address in this film, like, that Gary Farmer as Nobody is, you know... All right, well, there's... If we're talking about Westerns and the iconography, the quote-unquote, the Indians and the savages, they regrettably constitute a large part of Western storytelling. But here, Nobody as a character, he's pretty much the only one that's aware of what's going on. And, you know, his, him talking about, like, his life journey, you know, he's the child of two members of warring tribes who's then taken from his home and then educated in the new world, and then he comes back and he's ostracized. Like, he's a man without a home. But at the same time, he seems to be aware of sort of, like, the intellectual dimension and the spiritual dimension in ways that no other character is. So even though he's takes it upon himself to sort of bring Blake to the coast, it's not in, there's never a sense where it feels servile. If anything, he's dragging Blake and forcing Blake to, like, learn how to become himself.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's very much a case of, basically, he's stumbled across this individual, and it's like, okay, I can, you know, I'm gonna help him get to where he needs to be, because, but beyond that, you know, it's not, he will, he gives Blake a hard time and is clearly enjoying, what he, you know, more or less teaching him through, okay, I'm just gonna, you know, make this, you know, awkward and weird and interesting for him, as it goes through. And I'm not, not saying, you know, it's all, you know, him being mischievous, but there's, again, in Farmer's portrayal, there is sort of a mischievous streak to what nobody gets up to with Blake throughout this. That's very enjoyable. Now, this does...
We go from Kipling's idea of the noble savage to, as nobody would put it, stupid radio edit white man.
Yeah, exactly. Throughout this. And, I mean, it's very... It's, I'm trying to find it, because it's clearly one of the central joys of this film. I mean, full disclosure, again, this is a podcast hosted by two white Canadian men here, and...
Yeah, so I mean, like, we can't exactly comment on authenticity, or we're not the ultimate arbiters of identity politics.
Yeah, exactly, and I think it's one of those things where, you know, I in many ways, much of what we see in this film feels authentic, and it's partly why there's a degree of hesitancy on my part as to how much praise I want to give Jarmusch on this, because on one hand, you know, things such as, you know, I'm not going to make any claim to knowing which Aboriginal language is being spoken throughout this film, but, you know, there's a deliberate choice to have these characters speaking, you know, in non-subtitled languages other than English, in a way that is directly intended to, you know, to confront English language viewers and to put up that barrier, which is something that, again, for anybody who's looked at post-colonial fiction or post-colonial literature, is something that's used strategically throughout. Having said that, though, I mean, I hesitate to give too much credit here because, again, Jarmusch is a white filmmaker making, you know, a film about a white guy who goes on a spiritual journey. And yeah, ultimately it's about his recognition of, again, I'm trying to think about how you would phrase this, but the point being, ultimately, you know, it's the case of how much credit can we really give Jarmusch? Because I don't feel comfortable calling this a post-colonial text, because this isn't the colonized speaking back against the colonizer.
Jarmusch, and this is not a political film in the way that most post-colonial literature is. Like, this doesn't strike me as a film that's terribly concerned with post-colonialism as a project. That's not to say that the film's dismissive of it, but I think that is... That's kind of peripheral to what Jarmusch is trying to do. I think in a formal sense, though, I mean, going back to how the editing in the opening sequence, how that really causes us to identify with Blake's subjectivity, the fact that neither the audience nor Blake can understand what's being said around him, that just further reinforces, like, the limits of our own knowledge. And the idea of language itself, I mean... The imposition of language is pretty critical to the whole project of Western expansion.
Yeah.
And, you know, suddenly remembering that, oh, well, you know, English is not the only language that is sensible, and not funneling things through subtitles to make them sensible. I think that's important. And I think that, you know, it's certainly a progressive gesture. Again, that's not to say that's enough to end some flipping of genre codes. I wouldn't say that, yeah, this is a post-colonial film, but it does also lead to, I think, one of my favorite gags in the movie, where after Blake is wandering through the woods on his own, and he re-encounters nobody in the act of mid-coitus, and yeah. then he gets screamed at by an indigenous woman, nobody just turns to him and says, "Oh, don't worry too much. She didn't mean what she said about you."
Yes, absolutely. And I guess that also, you know, speaks to one of the other recurring motifs or ideas throughout this film is the sort of misinterpretation or mistranslation of various cultural codes and texts throughout it. Because, you know, on top of which we end up seeing things such as, I mean, obviously there's references to the works of William Blake in that, which nobody's basically the only one to have any sort of firm understanding of almost everything that encounters him. Which, again, sort of only positions him as a liminal figure. He's the person who, you know, despite his own, you know, as he puts it, you know, he prefers to be called nobody. And the sort of, you know, outsider status in every sort of regard in his life. You know, that ultimately makes him, I don't want to say survivor, because obviously by the time we get to the end of this film, that's not entirely the case. But he's able to function in a way that other characters can't. He's able to navigate the world and understand it in a way that Blake certainly can't, and certainly Cole can't, and other characters are fundamentally unable to.
But I think that's sort of why there is that bond between Nobody and Blake, because they're both men that are sort of, they're liminal between different worlds, you know, because Nobody in his own story, that his name in his own tongue effectively says, "He who speaks loudly says nothing," is
yeah,
it?
I think so, yeah.
Which is itself a reference to a James Brown song. But he's a man that's lived in various different worlds and has never felt at home in any of them. And now he's out in the West and he's the only person that's ever read poetry. And I think it's kind of funny that it's true. Nobody's read William Blake. But then Blake himself, he's a dead man in the world of the living, you know? So both of them are, they are strangers to the world that they inhabit. And I think that's why, that's the root of their affinity. Whereas everybody else is very singular and purpose-driven. And I think Cole is a good counterpoint to that, because all we really know about him is his dedication to a single purpose. And I think here might be a good opportunity to talk about some of the more interesting aspects of the film, and that's the three bounty hunters that Dickinson hires.
This is one of the things I had to praise on Twitter originally, because, God bless it, these are three actors in these roles that I love dearly, and they are such a joy to watch. I mean, Lance Henriksen, I mean, I've been a big fan since first encountering him in Millennium back in the late 90s, for those who remember that late, great program. But you have him as Cole, who probably the most experienced bounty hunter, single-minded, as we note, and as we come later to discover, is actually a cannibal.
Cannibal, and possibly even something beyond that. He may actually be, like, a supernatural being himself.
Yeah, so we've got him. We've got Michael Winnicott as Conway Twill. This man, the bounty hunter who will not shut up at any given time.
Yeah, he only stops talking when he's dead.
Yeah, exactly. And Eugene Bird, who is Johnny the Kid Pickett, who's the junior member of this crew and is just sort of put off by both of his compatriots as to, why am I with these gentlemen? How did I end up here? And, you know, is probably the most level-headed, human of the three. But, yeah, I mean, they're introduced in this, like, they're almost something Three Stooges-esque about how they're, particularly the way in which they're introduced.
Yes.
Which is them sitting in Dickinson's office, looking at his portrait, and all three of them just repeatedly pulling their guns, you know, in the sort of, you know, quick draw gesture, and pointing it at the portrait. just, you know, like, giddy children.
Which is odd, because, like, it then is established they don't know each other, they don't like each other, they don't want to work with each other, but our first introduction is them, yeah, just trying to kill time, so without a word, all of them just instinctively start playing Quick Draw against an ornate portrait of Robert Mitchum. And yeah, like, it's not that their dynamic is solely played for laughs, because it gets pretty chilling in a hurry, but there's something so strange about it. And you're right, like, that weird dynamic of, these two men, one who won't stop talking, one who never says anything, hanging out with basically a child. They say that, you know, the kid is, I think, 14. It's just they're this such a weird trio of individuals, and they're the ones who end up becoming like the antagonists of this film.
Yeah, and what's sort of notable though is that, you know, as the way in which this is structured, you'd think, you know, in a traditional Western, this would probably be built around repeated encounters with Blake and nobody over the course of it. And everybody sort of whittling each other down. Until the final. And that's not what happens here, because very quickly, this becomes, let's watch these three individuals take each other out, or more specifically, Cole taking each and his compatriots out for one reason or another over the course of this, until it's just him.
Yeah, there's no actual climactic standoff. And you're right, there's no moment where, you know, Cole sees them escape and, like, they lock eyes and then they know who their enemy is. This is a film where Cole is constantly pursuing them, but even at the end, like, he encounters them, but it's still at a remove, and Blake never has a moment of face-to-face.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the final shots of these films is basically nobody and Cole shooting each other to death simultaneously. In the sort of final gesture, as, you know, Blake is in the canoe going off to basically die out in the waters and sort of journey on his way into the afterlife. And it's staged in a way that, and again, there's almost something more.
That shot itself is composed very symmetrically.
Yeah.
Not just in terms of the positioning of bodies, but the way that Lance Henriksen and Gary Farmer actually move through that scene. Yeah. And you're right, like, there's this weird dualism of them firing at almost the same time, them falling opposite each other in almost identical ways. And yeah, again, that's one of those moments where it seems very suggestive of something, but I'm not totally sure what. But I think going back to one of your earlier points, David, where there is a pretty clear narrative in this film, but it's also not really narrative-driven. I think Cole's role in the film really speaks to that, where he is the antagonist, but the film is not at all concerned with that confrontation between protagonist and antagonist.
Yeah, no, absolutely not. I mean, they are basically off having their own weird little side story as they discover that, you know, Dickinson has, you know, after they've already taken on this mission and been paid in advance, Dickinson has now, you know, started wiring other city or towns and that, you know, to have other people going after Blake and Blake in this instance, more or less trying to cut them out of their job. And yeah, it just sort of goes from there in these, again, very weird little tangents, such as, again, you know, blowing Michael Wincott's character off screen away so we can cut back, you know, or fade back from black into this glorious moment of super dark humor, in which we discover that what is sort of set up as a way to sort of read as Wincott's Conway Twills, you know, he at one point he's talking to Johnny the Kid, and is basically it feels like he's trying to set the kid up as a way to get rid of Cole because he's too cowardly to do it himself. By telling this sort of ridiculous tale, it's like, oh yeah, he's a cannibal, ate his parents and everything, And it's just like, again, because his character never shuts up, you just think this is made up BS. No, no!
Yeah, it turns out that he's telling the truth.
Exactly, and you get just this wonderful shot of Lance Henriksen sitting around a fire, you know, picking the meat off of a
just contentedly chewing on a hand. Like, what's next? Is he going to pull out a harmonica and have himself a tune? But yeah, that's one of those things where the way that Henriksen plays it, it just, nope. Most natural thing in the world.
Exactly. And I mean, Henriksen's one of those actors I love, and it's always a shame that nobody has done more with him, because he's a talented cat. And he really, really should have a much bigger career than he does. Especially when you can see how well he plays moments like that and just deadpans his way through it in a way that, you know, some other actors would have maybe gone a bit more grotesque or, you know, more stylized with it than he does.
Sort of Tales from the Crypt level kind of villainy. But yeah, like, he keeps it subtle, and that's what makes him such just a menacing figure. That he doesn't speak much, but whenever he says something, there's always a very sinister intent behind it. Yeah, and like, even the moment where right before he kills Johnny the Kid, where he tells him not to drink from a pond of standing water. And Johnny brushes him off. He's like, yeah, why? He's like, could be bad for your health. And then he tells him off, turns around and starts drinking, and then he shoots him in the back of the head, you know?
Exactly.
It's one of those things where, like, it's shocking and it's outrageous, and it's not meant to be funny, but there's just something so morbid about it that, like, you kind of have to chuckle. Same thing with the Mountain Men sequence, where it is just so much strangeness all at the same time, but it never comes off like there's sort of like the wink to the audience of, hey, get a load of how silly this is.
Yeah, exactly. No, and I mean, it's very curious as I was watching the sequence, because I kept trying to figure out whether, again, this is Jarmusch trying to do some sort of weird echo and mirroring of the bounty hunters there, because again, it's very deliberate. You have three men with three very unique personalities who don't necessarily, I mean, they like each other more than the bounty hunters, but they're also very prone to violence and eliminating each other as quickly as they can as well. It's a weird thing, and I don't think I wasn't able to come up with anything sort of definitive, because I'm not really sure what is achieved in that sort of echo. But at the same time, you know, watching this weird quasi-family unit, you know, misinterpret and misunderstand the Bible, and they're sort of using it as a justification for everything they do, is, again, deeply funny, and again, kind of gets at, you know, again, a real sort of poking a needle at American culture as it currently is.
Well, yeah, sort of, and it's like when we talked about with Where the Buffalo Roam, how Neil Young's score in the film takes standard American songs and just sort of detours them slightly. And I mean, that kind of is the through line to this film, taking familiar aspects of American culture and detouring them. So instead of the Grant Wood American Gothic or the Norman Rockwell ideal family, instead we get Billy Bob Thornton wearing a big fuzzy jacket, Jared Harris yelling at everybody, and Iggy Pop wearing a dress reading from the Bible.
Yeah, which, you know, in a much lesser filmmaker's hands, the gag, they would probably make some really, you know, transphobic jokes about that. That's not what goes on here whatsoever in this scene. This is really just, you know, he's in the dress, but nobody makes a deal about it. It's just there. Yeah, it's like, if nobody questions it, nobody talks about it. It's just, he's there, he's reading from a Bible, and, you know, again, there's almost this weird way in which, again, these mountain men are more functional and, you know, I don't want to say decent, because again, ultimately they are killers at the end of the day here. But I mean, there is something more honest about them. compared to what's going on with, say, like Dickinson, who's upset that his son's been killed, but he also wants that horseback that Blake is riding off on.
My pinto. But if you think about, because we only get a few sequences in the town of Machine, but you think about the metalworks and the factory there, and even in the office, everyone's dressed identically, working at the same desk. Even in the town, everyone's going to the saloon. Like, I think there's something to be said for the idea that instead of the city, like, the city imposes civilization and imposes a certain kind of order like it does in every other Western, but here it does so destructively, and it flattens everything into homogeneity. Whereas out in the frontier, that's where we encounter the trio of bounty hunters, this weird surrogate family, the strange sequence at the trading post. Like, the west outside of the city, it's presented as, like, here's where all the things that cannot be contained or should not be contained within sort of the orderly westernized society, that's where all of it goes, and not all of it is good or constructive. But there is that sense of just organic weirdness, and they only encounter it by going through it.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And speaking of the trading post scene, I'm thinking of this. I'd like to also credit Jarmusch and company for how they stage the gun fights in this film, which, A, suggests that, when I say gunfight, like, this is a big action sequence. They're not. These are mostly composed, in, like, single-shot takes of somebody in the distance firing at somebody, and despite not being that far off, in some cases, still managing to miss, because that's how firearms, poor the firearms of the time were. And, again, even just, like, little things such as, Blake getting shot through the arm by a guy behind him, and almost having, like, next to no reaction when it happens is just very unique in its approach. Like, it's not, again, it's not shot like it's an action sequence, or it's like, this is the height of excitement. Like, they're just very perfunctory.
The same way that when Blake shoots Charlie at the beginning of the film, that Charlie's just standing in the doorway looking completely disenchanted because he's shot the woman that he loves. Yeah. Blake fires twice. Charlie doesn't even blink or look up. And then he finally looks over, and then he gets a bullet in the neck. Like, the violence in this film, it's not aestheticized or it's not romanticized. I mean, like, I shouldn't say that it's not stylized, because there's a certain formalism to it. But, like, instead of the idea of, like, the guy getting shot in, a 50s Western and then spinning and operatically falling before he says, like, his final goodbyes. Like, the violence in this film is quick, it's ugly, and it's visceral. Yeah. And that also makes it stand out, especially when you compare it to, say, The Lone Ranger, where Johnny Depp decided to play Tonto and forgot everything he learned about making this film.
Well, I was actually wondering if that would come up here, because, man, oh man, I just like to say I miss 90s Johnny Depp, the one who seemed to have a clear head on his shoulder and seemed, to be interested in doing things that weren't just mainstream, A, schlock, and B, outright offensive. Like, I'm struggling almost for words to say about this, because, I mean, it is so breathtaking, but it's one of those things where, again, it's... like, I feel like there's the danger of overselling it. Because, I mean, it's an amazing film, and even though I think we've spoiled a fair amount of it, again, I don't really think we have, because in large part, this is literally a case where you could say, it's the experience of watching the film that is more interesting than ultimately, the actual narrative itself. We can tell you the events, but until you actually see how it is assembled and constructed and put together, you're not really going to have a good sense as to what the film itself really is.
But I think, David, you might actually, you might be explaining perfectly what this film is about, because we've talked before about how we are subjectively linked to Blake's perception of the world that he's in. Yeah. And nothing makes sense to him. Images don't make sense to him. The location doesn't make sense. Time eventually stops making sense. Language doesn't make sense. You know, we are very much on that journey with him, and everything he encounters and is mystified by, we are as well. And, like, even when Blake sort of has that self-awareness and, like, recognizes himself as, I am William Blake, have you read my poetry? And he becomes, like, this confident killer, albeit briefly. We're not really given any insight as to what makes that change for him, or, you know, his own internal thoughts regarding that. So this is a film that I see as largely about the journey itself. And, like, it begins with Blake coming to the West, and it ends with him leaving the world. And along the way, like, we encounter all these different manifestations of beliefs, in a sense, where we have sort of the indigenous, like, folk spirituality of nobody. We have this weird, amoral, possibly supernatural being in Cole. We have the weird surrogate family reading and misinterpreting the Bible. We have Alfred Molina as the bigoted missionary at the trading post. Yeah. And, you know, going back to the film's conclusion where Blake in the boat, sort of getting a Viking burial effectively, how one of the last things he sees is nobody and Cole shooting each other and dying at the same time. Like, it almost feels like, what is it, Jacob's Ladder, I think? Just bear with me for a sec. I don't remember much of the movie Jacob's Ladder, but I remember Danny Aiello saying that some people believe that in hell the only thing that burns is the parts of you that want to remain human. So in a sense, it's like, in passing from the world of the living into the land of the dead, like, Blake can finally let go, because all these different figurations of, like, man's belief within the world, all of those finally are nullified. And when all of that's gone, he can finally move on. I see it something in terms of that. I could probably articulate it better when I'm not coming off of 8 hours of class and exhaustion. But does that sound plausible to you?
It's plausible. I mean, I would have to mull it a bit more over to come to sort of any definitive conclusions, or at least personal conclusions, as it relates to the film. I would say this does bring up a question, which I think is kind of interesting going back to, particularly our rather heated conversation on Heat. I'm never going to get tired of that pun. But I mean, which is, again, the sort of morality of what Blake ultimately becomes in the course of this film, because ostensibly, I mean, the society, obviously, that he's sort of escaping is corrupt and wrong and twisted. And the fact that he's on the run is for basically all the wrong reasons. At the same time, this is a man who is willingly become a killer. And it's interesting because, again, I don't know how we're to read, because I don't think Jarmusch is sitting there saying, you know, right on, Blake, you know, go kill everyone, because I don't think that's what he's saying. But I do think we're supposed to sort of identify with his transformation into an open killer as being, again, there's a catharsis to it, in a way. You know, there is some sort of sense of identity he has that is firm and fixed, and we should recognize as positive, if only because, again, he effectively is transgressing against this corrupt society.
Well, that's the interesting thing, though, because in a normal Western, you know, it would begin with a death, and then, you know, the hero has to go on that journey to discover his manhood and then get his revenge.
Yeah.
Blake gets his revenge, quote unquote. That's, like, the first thing he does, and that's why he goes on the run in the first place.
Yeah.
So by the time he, like, gets that confidence and that self-assertion, like, it's ultimately purposeless because there's nothing that he needs to rectify. And even if there was, there's never that moment of confrontation. Like, we don't see Dickinson again. He doesn't have a face-to-face with Cole. It's like, yeah, the question is, like, he has this sort of, like, turning point, but to what purpose?
Yeah, and I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, again, if you want to sort of read it in this sort of the in terms of America as a culture and America as a history and sort of what he's, you know, ultimately firing back at, to put it a little bit literally there for a second. I mean, yeah, it is ultimately, you know, Western expansionism itself and the sort of, you know, corruption that sort of pushed it forward. I mean, there is something incredibly satisfying about seeing, you know, Alfred Molina's, you know, crooked traitor slash priest get it when he's trying to sell things like blessed ammunition blessed by, what was it, the Archbishop of Michigan?
Detroit, I think?
something along those lines. You know, and, you know, that sinister line about we have some blankets, which is just like Molina just, you know, chews into that, the creepiness of that line and everything that's wrong with it. And it's that the case. It's just, it's very fascinating where, again, I honestly don't know where to pin Jarmusch in terms of what his take towards violence is. Not that it ultimately matters, but it's just very curious. Because again, this is a film where, you know, well, there's a line early on when Blake's with Thel and he discovers that there's a gun underneath her pillow. And he asks, you know, she has a line, he's like, "This is America." When he's asked to explain it, it's like, that's probably the most on-the-nose line of the entire movie. And yet, so that's a lot of meandering thoughts and, you know, stream of consciousness thinking that ultimately went nowhere on my part. But still.
Well, at the same time, though, like, Jarmusch as well as a filmmaker, like, even one of the things I'm realizing that connects his earlier work to his later work is that he's very interested in artifacts of American culture. And, you know, and sort of how America represents itself, sort of like the items and commodities that underpin the idea of America, especially music. But here, it's like, it's sort of playing with the symbols of a Western and rearranging them, maybe just as an inquisition or a meditation on, well, what do these symbols actually even mean? And do they mean the same thing when, you know, the wisest character is the dispossessed Aboriginal guide? Or when the city itself is, instead of being the safe haven for community, it's full of skeletons and an ironworks and things like that. It's just, I mean, that's the weird thing about this film, because in some respects, it is a collection of moments and a collection of images, but that also makes it sound much more haphazard and purposeless than I feel like the film is. Like, I don't think it's an accident that the film keeps making allusions to religion, for instance, or, you know, to familiar symbols of the West. It's just, when you're trying to place these things in dialogue with one another, like, I'm not sure if the film is trying to say anything overall with it, but at the same time, what's the alternative? That, okay, well, we just have, like, a gallery of images. Because we talked about with Heat, where I am not satisfied with that as a conclusion, but I don't know, it's weird. Like, maybe really the only way to read this film is to fully identify with Blake and just visit it and take whatever meaning and whatever knowledge can be gleaned from this bizarre, surrealist trip through the wilderness.
Indeed, that could very well be the case. And, I mean, I would say that's probably a good spot to sort of leave off on that little, as far as the film itself is concerned, while moving on to our hits and picks, hits and pits
hits
session.
And pits, yes. Patent pending, hits and pits. And, yes. Dave, I guess I got to pick this one, so why don't you start us off? Something that, for the uninitiated, the little moments in a film that we either enjoy or despise tremendously. So what is one of the hits that we haven't discussed yet?
Good question, because we've, you know, sort of really gone all over the map on this one. Certainly, I would probably say, again, this is a tough one, because it really does feel like we've hit sort of most of the highs of this film. But I guess I'll, you know, throw a bit of credit to Iggy Pop. For, you know, his sort of delightful comedic performance. in the film. It's a small moment. It's again, part of a larger, stranger scene, but it works really well. And, you know, he's clearly having a ball getting to just, you know, do things like discuss his cooking of beans, you know, and, you know, flipping through the Bible and looking for verses to read throughout it. So kudos there, I guess, on that one. But what about you, Andrew? Do you have something much more substantive? You know what? I'm too tired. Just, you know what I'm saying.
There's, I do love the sequence where when the bounty hunters set out on the road and they're all sleeping and the kid is creeping up on Michael Wincott's character, presumably to steal something from him. It's not totally clear from the shot composition itself until Wincott wakes up, points a gun at him, and then it's revealed that he's sleeping with a teddy bear.
Teddy bear, yes, yes.
I think that's one of the only moments in the film that comes off as, like, a purposeful gag. But there's something pretty funny about watching these three, like, incredibly bloodthirsty men, and they're really just fighting over possession of a stuffed bear.
Yeah, absolutely. That is just a sheer delight of a scene. And,
I'm trying to think about it, and I feel like we signaled a lot of things. I've got one more. David, do you have anything?
I was going to say, as far as a hit for sure, Johnny Depp's, you know, not quite a bowler hat, but whatever that hat is.
I think it's a pork pie hat?
It could be. I'm honestly, I wish my familiarity with the styles of hats is a bit wider than it is. But no, I mean, there is some, I mean, the whole costume, you know, design in throughout the film is really well done. Like, I mean, there is something, because you see a lot, many characters in very unique costumes, but it always feels of a piece. And so, like, nothing stands out like this is an overly out of place or overly theatrical or artificial for what it is. So kudos there. Particularly, again, seeing, you know, when it comes to Johnny Depp, how much wrong he could do by going that much further with it. Yes, Andrew, it sounded like you had something else there.
The one thing I don't think we have talked about is the one thing that brought us to this film, and that's Neil Young's score.
Yes.
Because it does, it actually has a very similar function as it does in Where the Buffalo Roam, but here, like, there's much more use of feedback and sort of different pedal effects and that. And, like, this is not a dialogue-heavy film, and a lot of the film is carried by Neil Young's score filling up the spaces. And from what I understand, he largely improvised all the musical sections watching footage of the film. So it's kind of like Peter and the Wolfing, but, like, there's just, like, a droning power behind it. And, like, the sound of his guitar just matches up with the monochrome photography almost perfectly. And this film would not resonate the way it does if it was any other score made by any other person.
I do find it very interesting that, you know, in order to get these sort of scores for films about, you know, America with a capital A, they had to go to a Canadian to do so. So. But yeah, no, absolutely, I am in full agreement with you on that one. As for Pitts, I think the obvious one, which we didn't really get to hit upon, but it's worth noting, is as much film as we can put towards its praise, as progressive as elements of it are, the absence of women in this film is kind of, it's very peculiar, because on one hand, it's not like this is a film about a sort of homosocial environment per se, because there are women there. It's just that the roles they have in this film are, you know, it's Thel who dies, it is nobody's partner, as it were, who has one scene where it's mainly for them to sleep together and her to get mad that it's interrupted. One of the first images that, you know, William Blake sees as he comes into town, which we will not describe because, again, this is, you know, ostensibly a PG podcast. You know, it's very noteworthy that, you know, these are sort of the few images we see of women in this film. Which, and then you factor in what goes the Iggy Pop popping up later in the film, which, as I just literally a few moments ago was praising the heck out of him for his performance, it does, you know, the fact that he is appearing, you know, in a dress, you know, ostensibly from the way it's presented, appearing in a sort of almost, you know, maternal role to the other two individuals that are make up his troupe. There is something kind of peculiar about the absence of women. And I don't know, I don't get the sense that that's one that Jarmusch did that on purpose, per se, in the sense of, you know, he was trying to make some sort of commentary about the absence of women.
I would almost disagree with you there. I think when we consider how the West is portrayed in this film, like, this is a film all about death and desiccation and inorganicism. And I don't know, I can definitely see a reading where the sort of exclusion of women from this film is a purposeful move. But I also feel like it's really an agendered film in the sense that even if that is like a conscientious move that Jarmusch is making, I feel like the film doesn't have any kind of internal critique of masculinity to really play off of that. So, I mean, yeah, like, I imagine to think of, you know, some of the female actors in 1995 that could have been noteworthy when given the freedom to be in a film like this one, working with a director like Jarmusch. It is strange, and I mean, definitely at surface glance, it is problematic where, yeah, literally the only women in this film are sex objects. Whether or not that's a deliberate critique or not, I mean, that's still the end result of this film.
Yeah, and I mean, it's certainly one of these cases. I mean, you can look at a film that's about as far from this as possible. It's something like John Carpenter's The Thing, which there are no women in that film. At the same time, that's a film, I think, that's very much about a particular sense of masculine paranoia and culture that, I mean, yeah, that's kind of ultimately, you know, the absence is part of what's going on in that film. And I just don't get that sense that in this particular film.
Is a film concerned with America and concerned with violence, but it's not necessarily concerned with, like, the construction of masculinity.
Yeah, so, again, this film gets so much right that I don't want to necessarily, you know, pin it like this is a fatal flaw in the film, but it is something that I think, any, you know, half a moment's thought will probably get recognized pretty quickly going into it. So, what about you, Andrew? What pits do you have, if any?
I would just say that more of a cautionary thing. This is, it's 2 hours long. It's not an overly long movie, but it's also a pretty miserable film, and it's very meditatively paced. So it's a bit of an investment. This is one of those movies you shouldn't put on to just have as background music at 11 o'clock at night. Like, it's one of those films that, because there's that looseness to it, it's, especially if you're coming into it for the first time, it's not totally clear where the film is going or what's going to be important, so you end up watching it attentively, but, like, that can take a lot out of you, especially given how grim the tone of the film is almost overall. So if you're expecting, like, you know, because we keep talking about Westerns, this is a Western, but of a very different form. So if you see the trailer for it online, you know, it makes it look like a much more of a 310 to Yuma kind of film than what it is. So that's not necessarily a failing of the film itself. I mean, this film wasn't hugely successful at the box office, and I mean, there's always the studio pressure of, well, we want to make money off of it, but this is, when we say that it's an art house Western, I'd say the needle is closer to the art house side than the Western side. Don't exactly expect the second coming of Rio Bravo here.
I will say I disagree with you slightly about, you know, not putting us on late at night. I can almost guarantee you that there was probably a point in which Cameron Bailey programmed this in the middle of the night on Showcase, back when they actually showed films at like 11 p.m. for the art house crowd. So just putting that out there.
All right. But yeah, I mean, like, in terms of nitpicking and whatever, it's like, yeah, there's there's nothing really wrong with this film. I mean, it's bizarre. It's hard to wrap your head around. It's sprawling. But, I mean, there's very little of it that I can point to and be like, that's a mistake. Or that takes away from it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's ultimately going to be, I mean, either you're on, again, we've used this before, but you're either on its wavelength or you're not. I mean, if you're not, I mean, if you're looking for something inherently just pleasurable as an easy sit, as you're noting here, Andrew, you know, that's not what this movie is. I mean, but if you're willing to go with it, you know, there's tons to get out of it.
Yeah, like, watch the opening train ride sequence, and that will basically be your perfect litmus test. If you're interested in it and you want to see where it's going, then by all means stick around. But if you walk away from that opening being, why does it keep fading? What's going on? Why does this guy seem to be talking about the future? If you can't get your head around that, well, that's the moment to cut it off, because it doesn't slow down for passengers.
Yeah, exactly.
But speaking of not slowing down, David, where is this film strip going to be going next?
Well, you'll be very happy to know that after, you know, a great deal of thought and consideration, we are not going to be discussing Crow City of Angels. I'm sorry, Andrew. I know you wanted to follow Iggy Pop there desperately.
Oh.
But no, instead, I think we're going to, you know, break the stranglehold that the 90s and 80s have had on this podcast so far by taking a jaunt down Robert Mitchum Boulevard to go all the way to Farewell, My Lovely from 1975, the adaptation of the classic Raymond Chandler novel, which was previously filmed several times, you know, as part of other mystery series, and ultimately done is the first proper Marlowe adaptation as Murder, My Sweet, starring Dick Powell, preceding us, which, by the way, we covered on the Late Great Cinema Chase as episode 2, so if you happen to still have that around, maybe give that one a listen prior to listening to our next podcast. But yes, we'll be taking like a Dick Richards, you know, 75 adaptation with Robert Mitchum and Charlotte Rampling. So,
ooh, I can't wait. It'll be a wonderful romp with the ramp.
Also, Harry Dean Stanton's in it as well. So I think at this
point, what is it with Harry Dean Stanton?
The band was a legend, man, dude. I mean, with good reason.
Well,
so.
Yeah. But, like, even when we're not trying to, all roads seem to be, like, just traveling parallel to Harry Dean Stanton. It's, honestly, like, even with this film, because I was trying to speculate where you were going to go, and I realized Robbie Mueller, having worked with Vendors, goes back to Harry Dean Stanton as well.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah, it's, he's, and here I thought that we kept coming back to Raul Julia a lot. But no, I can't wait. If there's one thing I love, it's hard-boiled detective fiction. I used to be a big Raymond Chandler buff. And if there's one thing that I'm never going to get tired of, it's watching Bob Mitchum do what Bob Mitchum does best. Other than getting arrested for possessing marijuana in the 1950s, but that's another story for another week.
Yes, so until then, you can find me as @24panels on Twitter. Andrew, people can finally follow you on Twitter, can't they?
Yes, they can. I've finally gotten back on Twitter. You can find me @FilmStripper. Believe it or not, given the popularity of adult entertainment, that name wasn't taken. So, yeah, you can follow along while I talk about movies and occasionally get into Twitter fights with famous scumbags.
Yeah, let's just not get kicked off this time. Like, don't pick on any poor wrestlers who have millions of more than we will ever have.
I was saying, he's not poor. He bankrupted Gawker.
Yeah, that's true.
So he's evidently got some money. But yeah, so as a rule of thumb, if it seems contentious, it's Andrew speaking as himself. And if it seems pleasant or charming, clearly David and I work together on that one.
I think that's, you know, anybody who's followed my Twitter feed will know that's not necessarily quite the case, but I digress. Don't forget also that all the music you hear on the show is by Andrew Kanagizer. And is there a place, Andrew, where they can hear more of your lovely tunes?
I don't really have a depository for the show music. Currently I'm looking at storage options, but for now, if you want to hear, my full-length records, including the breakout hit no one asked for, Aquaman Turn Up the Wet, head on over to SoundCloud, type in Andrew Kanagizer, and you will find it for the wonderful low price of free. Otherwise, yeah, just whatever podcatcher you use, feel free to rate and review us. 5-star reviews on iTunes are the best way that we can get an audience going. And, yeah, anything else you have to plug, Dave?
Not really. I think about the only thing I need to plug in is a CPAP and head to bed. But that's about, yeah.
All right. Well, until next week, I'm Andrew Kanegeiser.
And I'm Dave Babbitt.
And remember, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Goodbye, folks.